listener production.
A warning. This episode contains references to child sexual abuse. If this content affects you, the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. G'day, I'm former police officer Brent Sanders. And for the past 25 years, I've dedicated myself to sharing what I've learnt on the force to the Australian public so they can better protect themselves from falling victim to crime. So with the help of some of the most respected current and former detectives and high-ranking law enforcement agents, we're going to pull back the curtain on what life is like on the force and what they've learned about how crime and criminals really work. These are real stories from real detectives. This week, a detective who worked in the heartland of Melbourne's criminal world.
He actually had found a listening device in the roof of his house, but even though he had done that, it didn't stop him.
Noel is a 29-year veteran of the Victorian Police. He's asked us not to use his full name due to operational matters. We'll hear about what it took to bring down a high-profile drug trafficker who was moving from state to state, exploiting a South Australian legal loophole to deal high quantities of illicit drugs. But before we get to that, we're heading to St Kilda in Melbourne's inner city. A young man has just walked into a police station and a junior constable has taken his statement.
You have to give some accolades to the uniformed fellow on the front counter at the police station who was a little bit more inquiring than just asking some basic questions. I guess he smelled a rat. There's something not quite right. When the kid came in, he started asking him some questions. The kid was obviously disabled, mentally disabled. He was probably about a 15 or 16-year-old kid, but a mental capacity of much younger than that. The uniformed policeman found that the kid had been staying with a couple of adults in Elwood and didn't just smell right. So he suggested that we have a chat to him. We had a chat to him. And as it unfolded, it turns out the kid was had run away from home a few days earlier. He'd been wandering around the Flinders Street railway station and had been befriended by a couple of adults. And what ensued, of course, was distasteful. We took a statement off the kid with an independent person present, and we did an early morning raid the next day and took away a number of exhibits from the premises. Turns out that, with the fullness of time, we go to a committal. They're committed for trial on sexual penetration of a underage person, etc. Anyway, we go to trial, and one of the guys, he didn't accept the invitation and went on the run. The guy that did go to trial, I think he may have got 3 or 4 years, which you have to look at it through the prism of those days. These days, he'd probably get closer to 10 years for those offences, but it was a different time. And it certainly wasn't treated as severely as they are today. Anyway, so maybe a couple of years transpire, and the second offender was identified in the Northern Territory, in Katherine, actually. I flew up to extradite, successfully applied for his extradition. So then we've got to run another trial, at which time I need, of course, a victim. And the victim was in the ether, more or less. He's now a couple of years older, and I eventually track him down. Unfortunately, there are a number of events that had occurred in the ensuing couple of years that were going to make a trial difficult. So this kid is himself in and out of institutions. And when I tracked him down, I found that he'd actually been investigated several times for preying on younger children sexually as well. And I guess if you have a bit of a look at the circle of events, you have two guys that are brought up in institutions, you know, it's well documented now, the kind of activity that has taken place in some institutions over the years. And I guess, people become adjusted to that lifestyle. And you have the cycle where the abused becomes the abuser, same as perhaps somebody that's bullied at school becomes a bully, and those that are sexually preyed upon sometimes become predators themselves.
There's so many different ways to unpack this, Noel, but it's that cycle of events is, it doesn't justify, of course, the conduct or behaviour by any of these offenders, because as we know, Noel, there are tragically many young boys who are sexually abused who don't themselves become offenders. But of course, when they do and that cycle rolls on, very, very confronting on a number of levels, not least of all, I guess, Noel, someone in your role running that investigation.
Yeah, and look, as I said, though, there were different times. That particular CIB division, and I don't know whether it was the same in perhaps the western suburbs or the northern suburbs, but certainly St Kilda in those days, to a lesser extent now, but I don't think it's not that different, but I don't think there's anywhere near the level of the early 80s where there were just a lot of sex crimes running the whole gambit. Really, you know, a lot of crimes against women, often working girls, prostitutes. Certainly wasn't the level of scrutiny, I guess, and recourse open to them that we find today.
Noel, in this particular case, the offender that did go to court, pleaded guilty, received a custodial sentence. When you do the extradition of the second offender, what ends up happening then, the case sort of falls apart a little with regards to the time that's elapsed, the criminal activities now on behalf of the young man who was the victim. How does all that in the end, how does that sort of finish up, Noel?
Well, I guess luckily I didn't have to produce a victim because the accused pleaded guilty. Luckily, we didn't have to run a full-blown trial. It was an early plea and similar sentence to the first offender.
Noel, you mentioned the challenges, the multi-layered challenges of policing an environment like St Kilda in the 80s. You were in the CIB at that time, a detective. Noel, can you give us a bit of a broader overview of some of your roles and what it was like being a detective in St Kilda during that period of time?
I guess, again, unless you were there, it's very hard to convey the environment, the type of environment it was, because we look at things today and there's a lot of talk about ice and meth and stuff and pills and the effect that it has on society. And people today think, oh, well, hang on, this is just a problem for today. Oh, we've never seen this before, never seen anything like it. Well, in actual fact, if you go back to the 80s, late 70s and right through to, the 90s, heroin was a massive, massive issue everywhere, all over the country, but particularly St Kilda. It was the primary exchange area and domicile for drug dealers and drug users. Most drug users are drug dealers to some extent, and of course, what went with that was people having to fund their habit, and it was the days of new colour televisions and video recorders, which a lot of people wouldn't even know what they were now, and everybody had a VCR. So, you know, it would not be unusual to arrest somebody for doing burglaries and probably charge them with 40 or 50 burglaries over a week, where they just go and kick a front door in, pick up the telly and the video and into a waiting car, or in some cases even a waiting taxi, and off to the US pawnbroker. That was... it was a bit like the Wild Wild West, actually, in those days. It was pretty full on, very full on. So you had this massive drug trade, you had lots of burglaries, you had lots of sex offences, lots of assaults, serious assaults. People would come to St Kilda on the weekend, Friday night, Saturday night, to party. They'd come in from the suburbs. They'd be in an environment that they really had no real understanding of. And they'd often be seriously assaulted, end up in hospital. It was pretty common, very common.
It's interesting, Noel, isn't it? Everything changes, everything stays the same, doesn't it, Noel? And you know, the cycle that we talk about in behind it, there's the same sort of social issues in behind drug use and those selling, those using, that type of thing. And I guess after 20 or 30 years in that environment, Noel, it's must just grind you down.
Yeah, I think it. There are cycles in your life, I think. And I spent 4 years at St Kilda CIB, and I remember a guy that was there, he was going to work in one of the squads, and he said to me, "How long have you been here now?" I said, "I've been here a couple of years." And he said, "Well, if I were you, I would stay no longer than 3 years." Because he said it gets you down. It'll get to you eventually. And, you know, people, when you're in the zone, you don't actually see that you can't see the forest for the trees. And I actually stayed there 4 years. And that was definitely a mistake because, you know, it did take its toll on me. I was working very hard. I was drinking too much. I was playing too hard. And, you know, when I did leave, I was well past my use-by date at that place. I tell you, you know, they'd got their value out of me early days, but yeah, the last 12 months or so, probably not so much. It wasn't that productive. But then I moved on to another area and got reborn, if you like, rejuvenated and reinvigorated. And yeah, you can't work that hard and see those things day after day and not have some effect. And I'm actually probably pretty lucky, really, in a lot of ways that I actually came out of it pretty well, to tell you the truth.
Noel, if I can take you forward now in your career to 2000, you're a detective sergeant in the Victorian Organised Crime Squad, investigating a drug trafficking ring operating across borders between Victoria and New South Wales. Can you just walk us through your involvement in that, please?
Yeah, when I had previously been at the Gaming Advice Squad, and they did a reorganisation of the crime department and threw all the cards up in the air, and I went to the Organised Crime Squad, and upon arrival, the unit I was attached to had just been winding up a large heroin importing ring, and one of the persons that had just very briefly stepped into this group became a person of interest to the boss of the squad. He knew him from years earlier and slightly intrigued as to what his role had been, because it wasn't apparent. So we formed a group to have a close look at this guy. He was an old-time crook. He's I think a former painter and docker. And to tell you the truth, he was actually old school. He was quite a pleasant chap, really. He visited the main targets of this job once, went to their business premises, went straight to Tullamarine, jumped on a flight to Sydney, stayed a couple of hours, came back. Never any explanation as to what he did, motivating that. Anyway, this intrigued the powers that be at the time at the Organised Crime, so we had a bit of a look at him, and we found that he was doing a massive amount of kilometres. He lived in the southern suburbs of Melbourne. He'd jump in his car with a colleague, with a friend, and drive to Adelaide. He'd then spend a night in Adelaide. He'd then drive to Renmark, spend a night in Renmark. Then he'd drive to Sydney from Renmark. Then he'd drive to the northern beaches of New South Wales, then drive all the way back to Melbourne. And he'd do that about every 10 days. He'd have about a 5-day break in between, and then repeat it. And for a long time, weeks and weeks and weeks, we couldn't really work out what he was up to. At one stage, we had the highway patrol pick him up at, I think, in the Western District somewhere on his way to Adelaide. There was a large amount of cash in the boot of his car, I think from memory about 10 or 20K. The highway patrolman didn't make a big deal about it, just, he was just traffic. Doing a routine traffic stop, but certainly at that stage we you know, it piqued our interest. We knew he was definitely up to something. And we identified the people he was meeting in Adelaide. They had cannabis connections. The people he was meeting in Renmark, there was a truck driver who did a regular, as it turned out, did a regular run from Adelaide to Sydney with a load of steel. Person he was meeting in Sydney, yeah, minor drug matters, and same with the person that he was meeting in up the Northern Beaches. And this guy would change his phones. He'd have several phones. He'd change them. We, through good old-fashioned grassroots investigation, were able to, every time he changed his phones, we had the numbers very, very quickly. So we were able to update our telephone interception. And I'm not giving away too many secrets here because all this came out in court cases. What he was actually doing, even to this day, you can grow a couple of plants in Adelaide. And what actually I think most people do over there, it's a bit of a open slather. Most people grow more than a couple of plants. Anyway, this guy, the main guy in Adelaide, what he would do, he would ring around to all these people he knew that were growing dope. And over those, 15 days or whatever that we're in just between trips, he would get together about 20 pounds of cannabis. The guy from Melbourne would then facilitate the fellow in Renmark. He would come down with his truck. He would pick up the 20 pounds of cannabis. He would take them to Sydney. He would drop them all off in Sydney. And then the guy in Sydney would then take some of them to the Northern Beaches. And what the person in Melbourne was doing, he would then follow up. He would take money, pay the guy in Adelaide, and then he'd go to Sydney, collect money, and go to the Northern Beaches, collect money, and come back. And this cycle would go on about every 10 or 15 days.
To gather that sort of intelligence, Noel, and again, I don't want you giving away too many trade secrets, but as you say, most of this will come out in court cases anyway. I guess you're checking regos and cars crossing borders and trucks and what have you. The guy that's following up, collecting money, paying, was he under sort of physical surveillance? Was he being followed by police?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had surveillance on him in Melbourne. Either the surveillance in Melbourne would take him to Adelaide or would be met by the South Australian surveillance at Tailon Bend or somewhere like that. Same deal when the truck was moving from Adelaide to New South Wales, the New South Wales surveillance would pick them up at the border or somewhere near the border and then take them to Northern Beaches. And the same with when they're taking the main target around the place as well. They'd either do the whole trip, depending on manpower and availability of the other states. But, large level of cooperation.
A case like this, which is crossing regularly three state borders, how does that impede upon an investigation? Do the South Australian cops have to stop at the border and then they sort of pass the baton to Victoria and New South Wales? How does that work?
You don't have any powers in those other states unless you're sworn in as a special constable in those states. There's no impediment to you conducting inquiries, and that might be surveillance, no problem at all. Different story when you start talking about listening devices and things, but then you need warrants for that state or Commonwealth warrants, whatever. But it can be a little bit clunky, but once you get in the routine of it, it's okay.
So, Noel, you've gathered this intelligence, and obviously there's a building up of this intelligence, and then somebody at some point makes the decision, be it you or others, that you're going to pull the trigger and take steps towards arrest and prosecution. How does that evolve, and at what point, and what's the decision around that? What's the trigger? What determines that?
You have to come to a point where you actually are 100% certain as to what's going on. So once you work out what's exactly going on, then you go into your evidence gathering phase and you have to gather enough evidence to secure a conviction in court. Then you could be criticised if you let it run too long after that, because what you're doing is you're allowing offences to take place. So once you've gathered your evidence and you can show the crimes, have evidence of the crimes, then you're sort of duty bound to wind it up shortly after that.
the arrest that was made, and I think it was you that made it, was made in Adelaide. And would it then involve an extradition back to Victoria for this individual to face charges?
Yes. Of course, when you look at this job, there are a lot of targets. There's the main target, but there are a lot of people coming off that. There was the main target in Melbourne. He actually had found a listening device in the roof of his house. But even though he had done that, he didn't stop him. He still, I guess, I don't know what was in his mind, whether he thought, hang on, I need more money to fund a defence or something. I don't know. But he kept going. And but he did think that the end was near because he left the jurisdiction, went to the Gold Coast. So we actually had no targets in Melbourne when we came to make arrests. I had the truck pulled over in just before Sydney. Two of my men went up for the New South Wales Crime Department, made the arrests, and I had two of my chaps from the Organised Crime Squad there with them. There's Adelaide Police or Crime Department in Adelaide. They arrested the fellow in Adelaide. A few days later, I went over there and applied for that fellow's extradition. So the two guys from Renmark, they're arrested in New South Wales. New South Wales Police also arrested the main recipient in Sydney. They also arrested the guy in the Northern Beaches, and I sent another couple of detectives up to the Gold Coast to bring the main target and his colleague back to Melbourne.
How did it all finish up? Did you get a win at the end?
Yeah, we got a win in the end. Committal wasn't, I wouldn't say it was hotly contested, but there was a big argument over quantum, and quantum is where the prosecution and the defence argue over the size of the actual amount being trafficked, because we could show from, I guess, mainly telephone interception records and other paraphernalia, how many trips were undertaken over, say, an 18-month period. When we intercepted them, we say, oh, well, he did 15 trips, and we'd say he's probably done 20 pounds per trip. So, you know, you multiply that out. So, and the defence try and actually knock that down to make it, to lessen the gravity of the trafficking. And of course, I was the face of the investigation. So there are other elements that were friends of the accused who considered I was playing hardball and not caving in to bring the quantities down. And it became apparent to me that there were certain elements in Melbourne that weren't very happy with me. In actual fact, I had nothing to do with it. I couldn't have cared less, really. I'd done my job. I don't care, you know, whether it's £500 or £100 or whatever it is. It's irrelevant to me, really. It was actually really the lawyers that that decided to dig their heels in, not me.
Yeah, as you say, once you've put the brief together and you probably appear in court to give a bit of evidence, and then your job's done, and then it becomes a bit of an arm wrestle, doesn't it, between Crown prosecutors, defence counsels, and one thing and another. Did you get some custodial sentences out of it, Noel?
We did. I think everybody got the custodial sentences, which for the main target was, you know, in some ways a bit tough because he was no spring chicken. I think he was nearly 70, you know, when he went to jail. Which, you know, he did the crime, he had to do the time, unfortunately.
Noel, 1990 thereabouts, it saw the Crown Casino in Melbourne opening its doors for the first time, and with it came some concerns both from the police society and others with regards to that. Can you just have a chat to us about that, Noel?
Yeah, sure. I was a detective sergeant at the Victorian Gaming and Vice Court, and before I got there, they'd had a small number of personnel there. I think they had about three detectives working there initially. We were actually embedded in the casino. I think it was for the government. I think it was fear of the unknown. There were a bit of criticism from various circles about the actual casino itself being in existence, and I think the government were quite keen to make sure that they'll do their best to see that there were no really serious outfalls from the existence of the casino. One thing it did do, I guess on a positive note, depending on how you look at it, was put it almost an immediate stop to illegal gambling in Victoria. Like all the, around Chinatown, there was a lot, and other places, Carlton and whatever, there was a lot of illegal illegal gaming houses, you know, in hotel rooms and behind restaurants and all sorts of things. That actually basically stopped overnight.
So, Noel, you know, casinos, there's the upside, there's the glitzy sort of, you know, what we see in all the ads and what have you. But, of course, there's an undercurrent too. It becomes like you're policing an entity on its own. It's like you're in a suburb type of thing with all the different issues that police deal with. But you're doing it all within the under the roof of the casino. Can you give us a bit of a flavour for some of those incidences and investigations?
I guess it was a bit like a suburb. It was, even though we were squad detectives and probably most usually charged with investigating more serious and more difficult crimes to investigate, very much like working on a suburban CIB division, such with the range of the offences. A lot of sex crimes, sexual assault, a lot of physical assault, people drinking to excess and just, even today you hear people, we went to a party and then we all ended up at the casino and whatever. And I guess the volume of people was such that security there struggled to keep up with monitoring the level of some of the intoxication until it got a bit late. And then, you know, the police had to come and do something about it. We very rarely had uniformed police attend there. Normally we had to attend to it ourselves. So a lot of assault, a lot of thefts, assault and robs, a lot of thefts from patrons stealing from each other, or people just taking money off the tables, taking chips off the tables, claiming chips that weren't theirs, and every possible scam you could think of. One thing about it was they had very good surveillance, so we always had very good evidence of the offences once they'd taken place.
And of course, Noel, you know, again, when we look at casinos and we start to scrape the surface, be they in Sydney, Melbourne, or anywhere, little bit of a magnet for organised crime, bit of an environment to launder money and what have you. You'd have seen a few, if I could put it sort of quietly, colourful Melbourne identities coming in through the front door, no doubt, and always question marks, of course, over what they're doing there, how much money's changing hands. Is that something, Noel, that you had to keep a bit of an eye on in those early days?
Oh, we did, but I think really, to tell you the truth, there were a lot of those colourful identities in the early days. I don't think they banned anybody straight away. They did ban quite a few of them. And I always thought that was a bit counterproductive, actually, because I used to like to see who was talking to who. And I don't really think, look, they probably discussed criminal matters while they were there, but by and large, I think a lot of them used it as a social outlet more than anything else. It's somewhere they could go where they probably felt pretty safe because of the level of surveillance. And you'd see them talking to each other, some of them a bit more astute than others. They'd actually whisper in, they'd get close to their person they were talking to, and they'd cover their mouth with their hand so surveillance couldn't do any, they couldn't organise any lip reading or anything like that. They were pretty, some of them pretty good, but I didn't mind it actually. I used to like the idea of them all coming in and you could see who was friendly with who and who was perhaps not friendly with somebody else. Then of course we get into the later times when things started to turn a bit nasty in Melbourne and casino got a bit more wary about who was coming in. They started banning a lot more of them. A lot of the fears that I guess people didn't know what to be frightened of, they weren't always correct. I think money laundering was always one of the big fears, and yet it's not just simply a case of saying, oh, I won this money at the casino, or, you know, it's a bit more, you've got to be a bit more astute than that, and not that easy. Certainly some of the money from overseas, because you've got no idea where that came from, and it's paid into accounts in Australia, and yeah, big deal. You know, how do you follow it? Well, it's not really our job to follow it up anyway, because it's crime money from another country. But there was probably a lot of that. But as far as actually money, Australian money, not that easy to, you can't just say, oh, I've had a big win, because what actually happens, anyone that I guess has had a big win at a casino might know that you actually have to, you're not given the money, you're given a winner's check. And a winner's check is not just an ordinary check, and it's not just cash. And you have to show that you've had a winner's check to claim a win, to say you've won that money at a casino.
So, Noel, after joining the police as a young, fresh-faced 20-year-old back in the 70s, you moved on from the Victorian Police 2004 with just a whisker under 30 years service. Big transition, Noel, 2004, which direction did you go in at that point?
I went to work for another agency in Australia. I'd been seconded there briefly, and they made me an offer, and I had no plans to leave the police. At that stage, I intended to do at least my 30 years. They were of a view that I couldn't serve two masters, so they dug their heels in, and I had to resign from the police force, which wasn't really... I was earning a lot more money when I changed agencies, but that wasn't the motivation. It was really the change of working environment that appealed to me, to tell you the truth, and ended up by working there for another 8 years.
So within that agency, and we don't need to go into any more detail there now, through to 2012, and then you shut the door on that aspect of your career and slowly moved into a well-earned retirement.
It was certainly well earned by then, because I will say that there were some very difficult times in that second phase of my career. And really those sort of things happened at the wrong time of your life. If I'd been 30, I would have been probably a lot more resilient, but I wasn't. I was, I guess, in my 50s, and yeah, pretty happy to call it quits at that stage. Although my wife observes now that for that first 12 months I was quite not fully depressed, but certainly not that happy about life, because I'd come out of such a high energy, high pressure type lifestyle, you know, 40 phone calls a night, running three or four teams of strikes throughout the night, running it, you know, and then just to stop because you think you need to. Probably you need to really phase yourself out slowly, and I just stopped. And you know, I thought it was the right move, but probably not. It's hard to put your finger on what the problem was. I guess you know, if you really analyse it, you might decide you're perhaps a little bit less relevant than you used to be. You know, that we've all got an ego to some degree. And the thing is, too, you don't actually see this. You don't actually realise it's happening. Other people observe it, but you don't necessarily observe it. But these days, just onward and upward, very happy with life.
Noel, I want to thank you so much for being so open and candid in the talk here with us today, and also to thank you so very much for that close to 40 years service, serving the good people of Victoria and beyond. Great to meet you, and thank you for dropping in for a chat.
Absolute pleasure.
Crime Insiders Detectives is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Brent Sanders, produced by Ed Gooden, and sound designed and imaged by Link Kelly.